John Gielgud and Alan Bennett in 40 Years On by Alan Bennett, with Dorothy Reynolds, Paul Eddington, and Nora Nicholson.
Present, parents and old boys. It does not seem so many years since I stood in this hall on November the 11th, 1918, to hear the headmaster declare a half-holiday on the occasion of the signing of the armistice. That was my first term at Albion House as a schoolboy, and now I am headmaster, and it is my last term. It is a sad occasion. It is a sad occasion, but it is a proud occasion, too. I can see now some of the faces of my schoolfellows on that never-to-be-forgotten November morning, many of whose fathers, proud young trees for the felling, fell in that war. And in many a quiet English village there stands today a cenotaph, carved with their names, squire's son rubbing shoulders with blacksmith's boy in the magnificent equality of death. Scarce 20 summers sufficed to weather those names before England must needs take up arms in a second world war. And now that, too, has passed into history. None of you boys are old enough to remember that second war, nor even some of you masters. Yet I remember them both. I can still see myself standing at that window one summer day in 1918, and listening to the rumble of the guns in France. I stood at that window again in June 1940 to see a lone Spitfire tackle a squadron of the Luftwaffe. Those times left their mark on Albion House. Some of the older ones among you will remember Bombardier Tiffin, our corps commander and gym instructor, lately retired. And the more observant ones among you will have noticed that one of Bombardier Tiffin's legs was not his own. The other one, God bless him, was lost in the Great War. Some people lost other things, less tangible perhaps than legs, but no less worthwhile. They lost illusions. They lost hope. They lost faith. That is why... Chewing charters?
Sir.
That is why the 20s and the 30s were such a muddled and grubby time, for lack of all the hopes and ideals that perished on the fields of France. And don't put it in your handkerchief.
Sir.
Hopes and ideals which in this school and in schools like it all over the country we've always striven to keep alive in order to be worthy of those who died. It was Baden-Powell, I think it was Baden-Powell who said that a public schoolboy must be acceptable at a dance and invaluable in a shipwreck. But I don't think you'd be much use in either, Skinner, if you were playing with the hair of the boy in front. See me afterwards.
Yes, sir.
A silent prayer. O God, look down upon our bodies, which are made in thine own image. Let us delight in our boy bodies, that they may grow day by day into man bodies, that our boy thoughts may become man thoughts, and that on that glorious day when manhood dawns upon us, it may dawn upon us as on the clean, dewy grass, with birds singing in our hearts and innocence looking from our eyes.
Amen.
I haven't finished. As I was praying, so that day by day, as our bodies grow more beautiful, so too our soul life may grow more beautiful, as the soul is the mirror of the body, and the body is the mirror of the soul.
Amen. Amen.
This school, this Albion House, this little huddle of buildings in a fold of the Downs, home of a long line of English gentlemen, symbol of all that is most enduring in our hopes and traditions, 30 years ago today, Tupper, the Germans marched into Poland, and you're picking your nose. See me afterwards. We aren't a rich school. We aren't a powerful school. Not anymore. We don't set much store by cleverness at Albion House, so we don't run away with all the prizes. We used to do, of course, in the old days, and we must not forget those old days. But what we must remember is that we bequeathed our traditions to other schools. And if now they lead where we follow, it is because of that. My successor is well known to you all in the person of Mr. Franklin.
Hooray!
When the governors want your approval of their appointments, Wigglesworth, I'm sure they will ask for it. Mr. Franklin has long been my senior housemaster. Now he is promoted to pride of place. Doubtless the future will see many changes. Well, perhaps that is what the future is for. We cannot stand still even at the best of times. And now, as has always been the custom on this last day of term, staff and boys have come together to put on the play. Perhaps here I might say a word about Mr. Fairbrother, whose jealously guarded province the play has always been. I recall with particular pleasure that first trail-blazing production of Dear Octopus and last year's brave stab at Samson Agonistes. We shall miss him and his Delilah of that production, Miss Glenys Budd, who has contrived to delight us on innumerable occasions. And now, of course, she is Mrs. Fairbrother. Long may they flourish amidst the fleshpots of Torquay. Ave atque vale. Oh, God bless all those who leave and take their ways into the high places of the earth, that the end of leaving may be the beginning of loving, as the beginning of loving is the end of life, so that at the last seekers may become finders, and finders keepers, for thy name's sake. Amen. And Mr. Franklin has put together this term's production. Yeah, a short fling before he is crippled with the burden of administration. He has recruited a veritable galaxy of talent. Connoisseurs of the drama. Could they but spare the time from rummaging in the contents of their neighbor's ears, Jarvis. May be interested to note that I myself am to play some part in this year's proceedings. And on the distaff side, of course, no expense has been spared in procuring the services of Matron,
Hooray!
Miss Nisbet, and, of course, Mr. Tempest. Please, really, well, now if I could just see those boys whom I had occasion to admonish, we will sing the school song together, and the play will begin shortly. Skinner, Tupper.
40 years on, when the far and the sundown parted on those who are singing today, when you look back and forgetfully wonder what you were like in your work and your play, then it may be there will often come for you glimpses of notes like the catch of a song. Visions of boyhood shall float then before you, echoes of dreamland shall bear them along. Follow up, follow up, follow up, follow up, follow up, till the field rings again and again with the tramp of the 22 men.
Everyone not connected with the play off the stage right away.
Yes, I thought it best to say much as I've always said at the end of term. Like it or not, Franklin, boys are conservative creatures. The tug of ritual and the hold of habit, they like it.
They love it. Charles, have you seen Miss Nisbet?
The last time I saw her, she was en route for the lavatory.
What the hell's she doing there? I want her on stage. Miss Nisbet!
Oh, I'm so sorry. I just had to go to the bus.
Don't move an inch from this spot till the start.
Yes, Mr. Franklin.
Am I needed yet? Does anyone want me?
No, I don't think so. You touch that switch again, Crabtree, and I'll flay the bloody hide off you. What'll I do?
Flay the bloody hide off me, sir.
Right.
And don't swear, boy. It shows a lack of vocabulary.
Miss Nisbet, I thought I told you to stay here.
Well, I was just wondering whether I ought to put on a cardigan. Do you think I'll be warm enough? July can be very treacherous, and it's better to be safe than sorry. I might get something I can't get rid of. I don't think it's unreasonable to ask. After all, I've just nicely got over a cold, and I washed my hair last night. I should feel so much happier.
I wish I could put my hands on the choir's parts.
Wigglesworth, if I might just have a word in your fair, albeit somewhat grubby ear. That is a nut and this is a boat.
Yes, sir.
It is a long-established custom that the one goes inside the other. Thus, had your forefathers, Wigglesworth, been as stupid as you are, the human race would never have succeeded in procreating itself.
Surely somebody wants me, matron?
Yeah, I do, headmaster. I wonder if I might whisk you away and paint your face.
Well, I don't see why not, provided you exercise restraint. I'm still not altogether happy about this, you know, matron. I wish I'd never agreed to do it.
Go easy on the Helena Rubinstein, matron. He only wants the bare essentials.
The bits I have to do aren't so bad, but there are some bits I haven't even been allowed to see. I suppose that means it's either sex or God. Yeah, it'll be that business of the school magazine all over again. The trouble with you, Franklin, is that you have this unfortunate tendency to put ideas into the boys' heads.
I thought that's what education meant.
But I never liked the word education. I prefer the word schooling. Still, what does it matter?
That's the spirit.
Yes, besides, it's never been my policy to interfere with my housemasters. I've done my best. I've maintained the forms. I've not always believed in them, but I've maintained them.
You'll do. I'll just dust you off and your own mother wouldn't know you.
Well, are we ready? I am told that what we are about to see is neither comedy nor tragedy, but a mixture of both. And that's a jolly good opportunity for you, parents included, to keep your wits about you so as to tell the one from the other. And in those parts that are funny, and in those parts only, I shall expect you to laugh, and in other parts, well, the reverse. And intelligently, remembering always that as the crackling of thorns under a pot cartwright, so is the laughter of a fool. For what we are about to see, may the Lord make us truly thankful.
Where's Miss Nisbet?
Oh, hell.
All our past proclaims the future, Shakespeare's voice and Nelson's hand, Milton's faith and Wordsworth's trust, in this our chosen and our changeless land. The Albion House Dramatic Society presents Speak for England, Arthur, a memoir of the life and times of two nice people in a world we have lost. We begin a quarter of a century ago in the basement of Claridge's Hotel, London.
Come on, Nursey.
But I've left me gas mask.
Never mind.
If we've missed it, Nursey, I shall never forgive you. Mr. Franklin.
Don't call me Mr. Franklin.
But you've still got your gown on. Wars break out once, or at the most twice in a lifetime, and you have to lose your gas mask. It must be past 11 now.
It's all right. The ultimatum's for 11. The broadcast is after that.
Oh, now you leave my wireless alone. I understand it, see? You keep your fingers to yourself, young man. It's not a machine, you know, that you can do just as you like with.
In the cabinet room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany. You can imagine what a bitter blow it is to me that all my long struggle to win peace has failed.
Grovel, grovel, grovel. He's got so used to grovelling to Hitler, and now feels he has to grovel to us.
Do you mind? The Prime Minister's trying to speak.
And I'm trying to listen.
It would have been more successful. Up to the very last, it would have been quite possible to have...
What are you crying for, young lady? What's done is done. I knew there'd be tears. That Hitler has no business interfering with other people, even if they are foreign.
Well, thank God for that. What a relief.
There. Big blow. That's better.
We're at war. At long last, we're at war.
Things won't ever be the same, you know. It won't be the same world. Except that they say it'll be over by Christmas.
They said that last time, too. I heard in the lobbies he wanted to wriggle out of it, even at this stage. What have we got to do with Poland?
Poor old thing. I've always had a soft spot for him.
It's his mother I feel sorry for.
Collapse of all my hopes, my public life. Made it sound as if he'd just lost a by-election. Not determined the fate of Europe. It's September, you see. Hitler waited until the harvest's in.
Cheats never beat.
At least this time we know what we're fighting for.
We knew what we were fighting for last time.
What?
Watts dead long ago, and Pardon took his place.
We were fighting for...
honour and, lots of things I can't remember now, but I remember that I knew quite clearly then.
They can't have been very important if you can't remember them now.
One always forgets the most important things. It's the things one can't remember that stay with you.
I feel more light-hearted than I've done for years.
It's the end of our world, Nursie. They're rolling up the maps all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our lifetime.
There's a drop on your nose, dear. Here, use my handkerchief. Is that dinner down your frock, old dear?
I'd better get down to the house.
On a Sunday?
Oh, perhaps we'll come and sit in the gallery. It'll be a bit of history. Come along,
Nancy. Oh, I can't go yet. There's air raid on. I haven't got me gas mask. Oh, just think, all these people to knit for. There's not a minute to lose.
The year is 1900. As the bells rang out on that last day of the old century, they did not ring out the end of one era and the beginning of another. To enter upon the new century was not like opening a door and crossing a threshold. The old queen was still alive, and when she died, most of what she stood for lived on. And so, as the lights go up on the 20th century, we are still in the world of Elgar and Beerbohm, the age of Oscar Wilde.
Is there anything in the newspaper this morning with us?
They have named another battleship after Queen Victoria, ma'am.
Another? She must be beginning to think there's some resemblance. I see the Dean of Windsor has been consecrated Bishop of Bombay.
Bombay? If I may say so, ma'am, that seems to me to be taking Christianity a little too far.
And where is your good lady wife on this bright summer's morning?
Still at death's door, I'm afraid, my lady.
Still? But she's been there now for the last 16 years.
Yes, and I, my lady, have never left her bedside.
Great mistake, if I may say so. You should remember the proverb, a watched pot never boils. I must now speak to my nephew.
But I cannot see him anywhere.
A sure sign that he's in the vicinity. Gerald?
Good morning, Aunt Delia.
The weather is immaterial. Gerald, do I detect a somewhat military note in your appearance? What is the reason for these warlike habiliments?
I've been called to the colours.
Indeed, whereabouts?
South Africa.
South Africa? I trust that will not interfere with your attendance at my dances.
I'm afraid so.
How can the Zulu expect to be treated as civilised people when they declare war in the middle of the season?
It's not the Zulu, Aunt Cedilia, it's the Boer.
It comes to the same thing. I've never understood this liking for war. It panders to instincts already catered for within the scope of any respectable domestic establishment. Which brings me to my point. Your marriage. I've been going through my list and have hit upon the ideal person, Lady Maltby.
Lady Maltby? Is she not connected with trade?
Trade? Nonsense. Her father made a fortune by introducing the corset to the Eskimos. That is not trade. It is philanthropy.
And she is very old-fashioned, besides.
If by that you mean she dresses like her mother, yes, she is. But then all women dress like their mothers. That is their tragedy. No man ever does. That is his. You have something to say?
Yes, Aunt Cedilia. You see, I've been engaged before. Several times.
I'm aware that you've been engaged, though, if I may say so, much after the manner of a public lavatory. Often and for very short periods.
I don't think that's very funny, Tempest.
Sorry, Headmaster.
If you want to make people laugh, you shouldn't have to go to the lavatory to do it.
Yes, Headmaster.
And Skinner?
Yes, sir?
You may regard this as a heaven-sent opportunity to draw with your fountain pen on that boy's neck, but I don't. Continue, Tempest.
Yes. You must be married next week.
Impossible.
Impossible? There seems to be an element of defeatism in that reply. Why, pray?
Lady Dundown, Aunt Cedilia, I cannot marry Lady Maltby next week because Lady Maltby is my mother.
Well, would the week after do? I beg your pardon?
Lady Maltby is my mother.
For how long has this been the case?
Almost as long as I can remember.
I see. One question, Mr. Grosvenor. Was your mother ever married?
No. I must confess it, Lady Dundown, she never was.
Splendid. Well, wherein lies the difficulty? Your mother is a spinster, albeit not without blot. You, nameless, dishonoured, fatherless creature that you are, unmarried, married between your mother and yourself would make a decent man of you and an honest woman of her. Indeed, the arrangement seems so tidy, I'm surprised it does not happen more often in society. Dear me, how cold it has turned. I must go in and put on another rope of pearls. Your arm, Mr. Grosvenor, if you please.
Yes, Aunt Cedilia.
South of the border, I rode back one day. There in a bay of white, by candlelight, she knelt to pray. The mission was told me that I mustn't stay. South of the border, down Mexico way.
Delicate instrument. It is not a toy. Treat it well. Your life may depend on it. Your gas mask should be marked clearly with your name and identity card number. Take it with you wherever you go. Don't let it out of your sight, even when you're asleep. Practice wearing it for an hour each day until you're thoroughly accustomed to it. Failure to comply with
these... You've only had it on 5 minutes. A man said an hour.
Doesn't do to overdo it. Little an orphan.
I wonder where Christopher is. Oh, he said he's not allowed to say, but we would know where he is if he said he was where Charles and Lena spent their honeymoon.
Oswestry.
What?
Oswestry.
Nobody ever spent their honeymoon at Oswestry. I thought it was Paris.
The artillery go to Oswestry. Any other clues?
He says he saw Napoleon's tomb this morning. That doesn't sound very much like Oswestry to me.
You button your lip, young lady. Careless talk costs lives.
Oh, don't be silly, Nursie. There's only us here.
How do you know I'm not a German parachutist?
German parachutists don't knit, Nursie. Well, there's one thing. The weather's as perfect as it always is when the world is quaking. I remember just about this time of the year in 1914, Father saying much the same thing to Edmund Goss. He agreed and said it had been just the same in 1870.
They used to have really piping hot days. In 1911, during the Home Rule crisis, it was 97 degrees. 97.
It was too hot. It was too fine to last at the beginning of this century. Fine before 7, rain before 11, that's what I say. Oh, lend me your gas mask. I can do a bit of practice, just in case.
The year is 1906. In those days, it seemed the sun would always shine.
Queen's weather, we used to call it when the old queen was still alive. And that was how it was all those years before the war.
Then in 1914, it begins to rain, and all through the war and after, it never stops.
The war and everything that comes after, grey and wet and misty and nasty.
Never a fine day in the trenches, was there?
Rain on Armistice Day.
Rain on the queues that wait for the dough.
Rain on the wet tarmac as they search the empty sky, waiting for an old man with a piece of paper.
But over the smooth green lawns of the Edwardian era, the sun seemed always to shine. Like one's last summer term at school, that memory has turned all to gold.
Berkshire and Hampshire, Leicester and Rutland, those were the Edwardian counties. One breath of their pine-laden air, and I'm through the door in the wall, back in the land of lost content. I'm a young man on a summer afternoon at Melton or Beaver, sitting in the garden with my life before me, and the whole vale dumb in the heat. Is it my fancy? Did I ever take tea on those matchless lawns? Did apricots ripen against old walls, and the great horn still sound at sunset? One boat on the wan, listless waters of the lake, and nothing stirring in Europe for years and years and years.
No, it's not how it was. That's only how he thinks it was. Really, it was wars and rumours of wars, just like any other time.
Somewhere, somehow, somebody is smoking. It's you, boy, isn't it?
No, sir.
You mean yes, sir.
No, sir.
Don't bully me, sir. Smoking stunts the growth. Oh, it's you, matron.
Oh, sorry, headmaster.
Lying on bed on a morning, listening to the sounds of the great house coming to life around one. First, about 5, the soft closing of a door and a slow shuffling tread.
Edward the 7th going back to his own room.
Ah, what sights those walls had seen. Here, Here is Sargent's portrait of the Lavery sisters.
Here is Lancia's portrait of the Andrews sisters.
Now the day's over, night is drawing nigh, shadows of the evening steal across the sky.
When I was ill as a child at the turn of the century, I would have a nightlight burning in a green saucer of water, right through into the morning. And behind the scrap screen, a bed would be set up for Nanny Gibbons. Very late, as it seemed to me then, though downstairs the dancing would just be beginning, Nanny Gibbons came to bed.
Nanny?
What?
I've got a pain in my leg.
Do you wonder you've got pains in your legs when you won't do your business? Well, next time you'll sit there till you do. I've forgotten to fold your vest, young man. I can't turn my back for 2 minutes and clean on this afternoon.
I feel sick.
Do you wonder you feel sick sitting on them hot pipes? How many more times must I tell you? You sit on them pipes, you'll catch piles.
What are piles?
You mind your own business. Piles is piles, and you'll know soon enough when you catch them, because your insides will drop out and you'll die, and then where will you be? Lie down, sitting up at this time of night.
What time is it?
Time for Bedfordshire. Time you had your bottom smacked.
Can I have an apple?
No, you can't. Apples at this time of night. Apples don't grow on trees, you know.
What's that?
That's Nanny's medicine.
What for?
It's for Nanny's leg. Nanny's got a bone in her leg.
Can I have some for my leg?
No, you can't. Going out without your wellies on. Do you wonder you get pains in your legs? You go out without your wellies on, you'll go blind. That's why St. Paul went blind, went out on the Damascus Road without his wellies on. See, did I say no? Lie down this minute. If I have another muff out of you, there'll be ructions. Give us a kiss. Kisses make babies grow. Night, night, sleep tight. God bless and go to sleep, or the policeman will come and cut your little tail off.
Now the day's over, night is drawing nigh, shadows of the evening steal across the sky. Now the darkness colors, stars begin to pass.
My duty was plain. I sought an audience of the king this evening and tendered to him my resignation, which his majesty has been pleased to accept.
Never be prime minister at the start of a war, Nursey.
Your Majesty has now entrusted...
Some of us have got better things to do. Good riddance of bad rubbish, that's what I say. Here, you're not doing anything for the war effort. Mm. You wind this wool.
So it's the same. Asquith, the younger Pitt, the heart's not in it. The man who's led you into it isn't the one to lead you out of it.
Chamberlain, Chamberlain, fly away home. Your house is on fire and your children all gone. I always had a soft spot for him. And what has Churchill done? He's just a troublemaker. Why couldn't they have Halifax?
How many more times do I have to tell you, don't play with that wireless, see? I've just put a new accumulator in. It's got to last me for the duration.
Oh, I heard a joke in the canteen today. What did Hitler say when he fell through the bed?
I don't know. What did Hitler say when he fell through the bed?
At last, I'm in Poland.
Mitch, I must apologize to all parents.
Willy, Willy, Harry, C, Harry, Dick, John, Harry, 3. 1, 2, 3, Ned, Richard, 2. Henry's 4, 5, 6, then who? Tudor, Henry, 7 and 8. Edward, Mary, and Elizabeth. James, 2, Charles, James again. William and Mary, and the plane. 4, George's Hanover. William 4, Victoria.
And who came after Queen Victoria? Rumbold.
I don't know, sir.
Someone once said, Rumbold, that education is what is left when you've forgotten all you've ever learned. You appear to be trying to circumvent the process by learning as little as possible. Wigglesworth.
Edward, sir.
Edward what?
Edward the Seventh, sir.
And who came after Edward the Seventh?
They all did.
And what do we know of Edward the Seventh? Who haven't I asked? Rumbold. Nothing. He knew nothing of Queen Victoria. He knows nothing of Edward the Seventh. You're a stupid boy, Rumbold, but by God, you're a consistent one. What's all this din, Charters? Is it in the script?
No, sir. It's the
Ruggedy. Is it?
Well, fill along the piano while I get this sorted out. Roger!
A slight technical hitch, ladies and gentlemen, but worse than happen at sea. In the meantime, I do my best to entertain you at the piano.
Oh, God.
Franklin, Franklin, what is happening? Tell us, what is this hiatus in the proceedings?
Mr. Franklin's gone out to try and stop the singing, headmaster.
Stop it? Do you mean to say it's not part of the entertainment?
It's entirely spontaneous.
Spontaneous? Then it must be stopped at once.
Matron,
that's enough! Now then, Franklin, who's been acting the giddy goat? You, Treadgold? You should know better than this, Treadgold. A school prefect, captain of games, father, a governor of the school. Oh, Treadgold, you disappoint me.
I do apologize, sir, but it's the Rugger team, just back from Stowe. We licked them, sir, 17-6.
Oh, dismal youth with your boots knocking about your neck. It's all very well to apologize. 17-6! Oh, Treadgold, well done, well done. Take your hand off Treadgold's collar, Franklin. School prefect, captain of games, father, a governor of the school, doesn't need you hanging onto his collar. I think a short prayer might not come amiss. Oh, God, let us give thanks for the warm embrace of the sun and the chaste kiss of the rain, thanking thee as we match our splendid young limbs against each other in the rough and the tumble of our games together, so that at the last, rain-washed, sun-gilt, heaven-bent, we may repose upon thy eternal changelessness, and thus at the last, when we are called to go, whither we know not hence, we may see God. You won't find him down there, Tupper.
Sir.
And bask in the presence of his glory from henceforth unto henceforth. Amen. 17-6. Amen. Amen.
I think they'd appreciate it, sir, if you spoke to them.
Do you think so? Oh, certainly, certainly. I'll speak to them at once. 17-6.
Treadgold, you privileged great lout. Kindly inform your little male voice choir that if I ever get my hands on them, they'll be singing several octaves higher.
Get out of my sight and love you before I strangle you in your own boot naked.
Treadgold, keep them under wraps, old chap. Take them behind the fifes court where they can sing to their heart's content.
Sir.
I'd better say at this juncture, Franklin, that I am not entirely pleased with the way things are going.
I refuse to be held responsible for a coachload of drunken louts.
I wasn't referring to that. Boy of nature filling its lungs and shouting forth its full-throated praise of physical prowess. No harm in that. I was 18 myself once.
You should want witnesses of that.
No, there is an element of mockery here that I don't like. I don't mind your tongue being in your cheek, but I suspect your heart is there with it.
Well, you can't expect to agree with everything. One generation treading on the toes of its predecessors. That's what tradition means.
I am still headmaster. Do not try to tell me what tradition means. Anyway, get on. Whose turn is it now?
Yours, headmaster.
Clear the stage, then. Clear the stage. I can't start with you dogging my every footstep. Lights, please.
T.E. Lawrence sets out for Mesopotamia, 1909. He had a spare shirt and stockings, a camera, and a borrowed map. He was 21, and he was going ostensibly to search for material for a thesis on Crusader castles. It was the start of a longer search.
T.E. Lawrence, the man and the myth. Which is man and which is myth? Is this fact or is it lies? What is truth and what is fable? Where is Ruth and where is Mabel? To some of these questions, I hope to be able to provide an answer. No one who knew T.E. Lawrence, as I did, scarcely at all, could fail but to be deeply impressed with him. It is given to few men to become, as he did, a legend in his own lifetime, and it was in pursuit of that legend that I first sought him out in June of 1933 at his cottage at Clouds Hill in Dorset. First slide, please. It was a simple cottage, but I thought I detected Lawrence's hand in the rough whitewashed wall, the stout paved doorstep, and the rough oak door upon which I knocked lightly. It was opened by a small, rather unprepossessing figure, slight of frame, fair-haired, and with the ruddy, gleaming face of a schoolboy. It was a schoolboy. I had come to the wrong house. Next slide, please. Some of us are a little old to stand on our heads, Crabtree. Thank you. I knew of Lawrence, of course, from his exploits in Syria, where he had been attached, though none too deeply, to the British Expeditionary Force. Speaking fluent Sanskrit, he and his Arab body servant, an unmade Bedouin of great beauty, had wreaked havoc among the Turkish levies. Orents, the Arabs called him, for they are unable to pronounce their L's, as distinct from the Chinese who can pronounce little else. It is interesting, though fruitless, to speculate that had fate taken him to China, he would have been known as Lollens. However, that is by the way. It was at this time that he was taken for a Circassian eunuch by the infamous Sheikh Hans and subjected to unspeakable privations, the marks of which he bore for the rest of his life and which bore everyone else thereafter. Next slide, please. Shaw, or Ross, as Lawrence then called himself, returned from the East in 1919. Shyness had always been a disease with him, and it was shyness and a longing for anonymity that made him disguise himself. Clad in the magnificent white silk robes of an Arab prince and wearing in his belt the short curved gold sword of the Ashraf descendants of the Prophet, he hoped to pass unnoticed through London. Alas, he was mistaken. "Who am I?" he would cry despairingly. "You are Lawrence of Arabia," passers-by would stop him and say, "and I claim my £5. For a while he sought refuge in academic seclusion as a fellow of All Souls College in Oxford. Next. And here he could mix on equal terms with some of the greatest men of his age. But, as Robert Graves has noted, he could not bear to be touched, so that even to rub shoulders with the great filled him with a deep loathing. Next slide, please. There have been those, as there always are those, who have said that there was something feminine about his makeup, but his was always so discreet. And can one ever forget him, those china blue eyes, that boyish, almost girlish figure, and that silly, silly giggle? The boys at his school had always called him Tee-hee Lawrence. Yes, and always at the back of his hand or the back of his mind, there was that ready snigger. When I became headmaster, the first boy I ever expelled was for reading the works of Lawrence. And this morning I receive in my post a letter from the Oxford and Cambridge Matriculation Board telling me that the works of Lawrence are next year's set texts. I just can't keep up.
D.H., headmaster, not T.E.
Those literary fellows, they're all the same.
My missus looked at me and she said, "What good are?" I said, "How do you mean, what good am I?" "Well," she said, "you're too old for the army. You couldn't get into the Navy, and they wouldn't..."
We are interrupting this broadcast for a message of national importance. At 3 o'clock this afternoon, the Admiralty issued the following appeal. All yachtsmen and owners of seagoing craft in the neighbourhood of the Channel ports are asked to report to their respective harbour masters without delay. Ships should be seaworthy and capable of immediate active service. That is the end of the announcement.
But he's missing, Nursie.
Missing? Missing? Oh, that's him all over. Never there when he's wanted, that boy. Oh, he'll turn up.
They said at the War Office somebody saw him still on the beach when the last boats were leaving.
There must have been hundreds left. I don't know how any got away at all. Oh, he never would push himself forward.
He was a dawdler. Everything done at the last minute. He'd be late for his own funeral.
I can't bear not knowing one way or the other.
Exactly. Anyone with a bit of consideration would have sent a postcard. There must be plenty of those at Seaside Place. Here, hold this wool for me. It'll occupy your mind.
I've been down at Victoria all day serving tea. I kept asking and asking. Poor lambs, they had to be turned out of the carriages, they were so tired.
I saw some of them in the park when I was walking to the ministry. Hundreds of them, just laid out on the grass in their stockinged feet. There was one boatload landed right on the common steps. I hope some of the Munichers were there to see that. I've put his name on the list in the Times. We shall just have to wait.
It's all waiting so far, this war. Waiting for the bombs, waiting for the troops. Is it ever going to start?
Patience is mine. I will delay, saith the Lord.
June 1914. Osbert Sitwell visits a palmist. Nearly all my brother officers of my own age had been 2 or 3 months earlier to see a celebrated palmist of the period. In each instance, it appears the Kuruman had begun to read their fortunes, when in sudden bewilderment she had thrown the outstretched hand from her, crying, "I don't understand it. It's the same thing again. After 2 or 3 months, the line of life stops short, and I can read nothing." When I was told by 4 or 5 persons of the same experience, I wondered what it could portend. But nothing could happen. Nothing.
They shall not grow old as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them.
Remember them because they had, in measure rich and abundant, the quality of grace. Grace of body, grace of manner, grace of movement. It was an awfully careless grace, bred out of money and leisure and the assurance they gave. And I don't suppose it would find much favour today.
Edward Horner, Raymond Asquith, Shaw Stewart and the Grenfells. They were not passionately concerned with the shortcomings of the world. It was still too rich and enthralling a place for them to find much fault with it. That great free world in which comity prevailed.
Like 100 or so young men of my acquaintance, I had spent the evening of August the 3rd, 1914, dutifully dancing to Mr. Cassani's band at Dorchester House. Dutifully because it was the end of the season and the weather sultry. I was bored and longing to be up in Scotland. "We are cutting," said Edward Horner as we came out of the supper room. He had had a fancy to hear the nightingales down at Kimber, and soon he, Julian and Billy Grenfell, Patrick Shaw Stewart and myself were in the Grenfell motor shooting down Park Lane. It occurred to me as we passed the Achilles statue that one of the partners on my card, whom I'd cut, was Princess Lichnowsky, the wife of the German ambassador, but I'd call the next day and apologize. And so through that short summer night, we motored down the white roads into Kent. We've forgotten since how strong and fresh and pure was in those days the first sensation of speed. But ours was a generation to discover it. Our parents didn't know it. Our children, such of us who survived to have them, took it for granted. But in that open car, running down to Kimber at 30 miles an hour, it was as if we'd been made sensible of the very force of life itself. We walked up through Kimber Park to find the house locked and shuttered for the summer. But the latch of the nursery window was broken, as it had always been for as long as I could remember, and so we broke into the silent house. Here still were all the pictures I remembered from the countless Kimber holidays of my childhood. The arming of the king, the piper of dreams, a little child shall lead them, for he had spoken lightly of a woman's name. And then through the house, Patrick breaking back the tall shutters as we went, furniture sheeted, drug it down, chandeliers done up in bags, and moonlight like frost about the room. On an impulse, I pulled back the white porcelain handle of the bell by a fireplace and heard, far away across the court in the deserted kitchen, a faint answering ring. We filed up the staircase to the galleries and the staterooms and through the bright chestnut varnish of the night nursery to the housekeeper's door, where I'd not been since I was a child and all the house was my province. It opened onto the maid's corridor, a narrow strip of carpet running away over the wide uneven boards under the ribs of the house, still close and heavy from the afternoon heat. We climbed out onto the leads, among the turrets and the towers and the green copper cupola. I remember the weather vane shrill singing in the breeze and the lanyard slapping the mast as Julian Grenfell broke the square medieval flag over the dark house. I would like to think that up there on the leads at Kimber, where within months I should stand to hear the guns in France, I would like to think But on that summer night in 1914, the shiver I felt was one of foreboding. But if I shivered, I feared it was only because it was the hour before dawn and cold up there on the roof. And if I felt a shadow come across the moment, it was only because young, rich, and as I see now, happy, I could afford melancholy. For another day, another ball had ended, and life had not yielded up its secret. This time, I always thought as I tied my tie, perhaps this time, but there would be other nights and time yet, I thought. And so we waited on that short midsummer night, and a deer barked, and our footsteps were dull on the leads. And then, as the light seeped back into the sky, suddenly, just before dawn, we heard the nightingales.
Ladies and gentlemen, during the interval, coffee is available in the master's common room.
Free of charge.
Oh, yeah, free of charge. You'll be shedding a few quiet tears tonight, Headmaster, handing over the ship after so long.
Retirement offers its own challenge, Matron, a chance to take up the slack of the mind, savour the rich broth of a lifetime's experience. Of course, I'm not going far. I want to be within striking distance of the boys. Biting your nails, Leadbetter, have you no moral sense at all?
I don't know what Mr. Franklin will do without you.
Don't you? The first thing he'll do is to abolish corporal punishment. The second thing he'll do is to abolish compulsory games. And the third thing he'll do is to abolish the cadet corps. These are the three things that liberal schoolmasters always do, Matron, the first opportunity they get. They think it makes the sensitive boys happy. In my experience, sensitive boys are never happy anyway, so what is the point?
Bit of a change from Fairbrother, all this. A far cry from Dear Octopus.
It is, it is. I suppose it's for the best.
I'm sure it is.
I wish I were.
Ah, the lusty Wimpany. What's the ginger nut situation like?
If you're going to take the radical step and throw Dodie Smith out of the window, warts and all, as it were, you've got to have something to put in her place.
We had got into a rut, though.
Perhaps, but the advantage with ruts, Matron, is that when one is in them, one knows exactly where one is.
Matron?
Oh, Christmas. Dishforth is being sick again. I must be about my errands of mercy. Get his head between his knees. No, not your knees, Rumbold.
I wonder, are there any windows open? It's terribly hot. All these boys take up far more oxygen than they should. Mr. Franklin, I wonder if you've nothing better to do, could you open one of the windows?
Why don't you take that thick cardigan off?
If I did, I shouldn't feel the benefit.
One of the fundamental principles upon which human society is based, Wimpany, is that people do not comb their hair over the ginger nuts.
They're digestives, sir.
You'll be digestives, too, if I catch you. Desist.
Do you think anybody would be offended if I opened a button of my blouse?
Have a care, Miss Nisbet, lest you unleash forces you're powerless to control. Matron, you dark horse. Hmm? Who would ever have suspected that beneath that starched front lay such histrionic talent?
Oh, go on with you.
You're wasted among your lineaments, your embrocation, Molly. Fate intended you for something better, as it did me, I think.
Tell you something that strikes a chord in this old heart. All that business about the war. Oh, gosh, yes. It's really down memory lane for me, because I was, for a time anyway, 2IC 36 ACAC battery. I don't know, I somehow seemed to come into my own roundabout then. The thing was, we were doing an absolutely essential job and enjoying it like hell. The battery commander was one Ron Prentice. Sweet soul, but so cheeky. I got quite silly about him. Me! Like a little fox terrier he was. I don't know, before the war, boys were always put off by my fat legs. Came the war, nobody seemed to care whether you had fat legs or not. I suppose, like everything else, fat legs got swallowed up in the larger issue. Those tense days in the summer of 1940 when we really thought the Hun would be here any minute. He really helped me to discover myself, did Ron? widened my horizons terribly. It was under his auspices I had my first cigarette. Then, in slack periods, we'd adjourn to the local hostelry for a festive gin and tonic. Golly, it was nice.
War is a strange alchemist.
Hey-ho.
Oh, Franklin, there you are. Would it be impossibly naive and old-fashioned of me to ask what it is you are trying to accomplish in this impudent charade?
You could say we're trying to shed the burden of the past.
Shed it? Why must we shed it? Why not shoulder it? Memories are not shackles, Franklin. They are garlands.
We're too tied to the past. We want to be free and look to the future. The future comes before the past.
Nonsense. The future comes after the past. Otherwise, it couldn't be the future. It's very easy to be daring and outspoken, Franklin, but once you're at the helm, the impetus will pass. One thing at least I will say. While I've been headmaster, Albion House has always been a going concern. Whether that will continue, I am not sure. It depends on you, Franklin. But I'm not sure of anything nowadays. I'm lost. I'm adrift. Everywhere one looks decadence. I saw a bishop with a moustache the other day.
It had to come. Oh, Molly, see if you can get the old man out of the way for the first bit, or he'll be breezing onto the stage again.
Will do. Headmaster, I wonder if you'd come up to the San and have a look at Dishforth. Not a pleasant sight at the best of times, but he's a bit on the pasty side.
Can I be spared?
Oh, I think we can just about manage.
Very well. And now, if all the parents are back in their seats, I'll just inaugurate the proceedings. If I don't say a prayer, nobody else will. O God, who has given unto each one of us a part to play in this great drama we call life, help us so to sustain our roles that when the lights of life go down and the last curtain falls, we may put off the motley of self and the raiment of sin and take our place at last in that great chorus line of saints, evermore praising thee around the glassy sea.
Hear, hear.
It is customary, Wimpernick, to say amen at the end of a prayer, not hear, hear. That is heresy, and it is also impudence. And remember, this is a school play. You're not here to enjoy yourselves.
Still less each other. Skinner, Tupper.
The splendour falls on castle walls and snowy summits old in story. The long light shakes across the lakes, and the wild cataract leaps in glory.
Eating, boy?
A sweet, sir.
Do you hear that, boy?
Yes, sir.
Do you know what it is?
Yes, sir. It's the guns in Flanders, sir.
Precisely. Young men are not busy laying down their lives in Flanders simply that you may eat sweets, particularly in my lesson. Always we must be worthy, worthy of those who die. It is for us that they are going down into the river, and they are watching us from the farther bank. How can we be worthy? No, we can make a start by not eating sweets in class, and we can follow it up faster by not passing notes to the boy in front.
Will it be over before it's our turn, sir?
Well, it depends on you, Foster. The army is not yet so depleted in numbers that it will take someone who cannot master Latin gerundives. Take this down. If the 10 million dead of the 1914-18 war were to march in columns of four into the gates of death, they would take 80 days and 80 nights to pass through, and for 80 days the marchers would be the British dead. In the light of that information, I want you to calculate, one, the width of the gates of death to the nearest centimetre, and two, the speed in miles per hour at which the column was marching.
Quite enough, you boys, quite enough.
Oh, Carol, that's a lovely tune they're playing.
I'm awfully glad you like it, Johnny.
What's its name, Carol?
Well, it's called...
A woman at the canteen said that her son, who's in the Ministry of Food, says that it's common knowledge that Hitler died 6 months ago, only it's being hushed up.
The Times correspondent says that air raids are having a serious effect on bridge.
Lindo in the People says they won't invade until Venus is under Capricorn.
When's that?
1947.
A man has been arrested in Epsom for signalling to German planes with a lighted cigarette.
Apparently they've tried one invasion already. They say that
the channel was white with bodies.
Oh. They say that some of the Luftwaffe pilots who've been shot down were wearing lipstick and rouge.
A German agent has reported that London is now so demoralised that titled ladies are relieving themselves in Hyde Park.
And there was a nun on my bus today, paid her fare with a man's hand. What's the matter with that bit?
It's burnt.
Of course it's burnt. It's to make your hair curl. Oh, and you haven't eaten your cabbage. Cabbage is bottled sunshine.
I walked through Bloomsbury this morning. It's really caught it this time. Glass on the pavements, thick as autumn leaves in Vallombrosa.
Better the devil you know. If Hitler hadn't done it, London University would.
Half Tavistock Square's down. Odd houses knocked out here and there, like teeth. Just a mirror hanging high up on a wall where once was 52, and somebody's coat on a peg in an attic.
Well, they were appealing down at the canteen for us to ask soldiers in for a bath.
Oh, I wouldn't fancy that. They might be dirty.
Leonard Wolfe and the Beginning of Bloomsbury. In March 1922, we started the Memoir Club, and on March the 6th, we met in Gordon Square, dined together, and listened to or read our memoirs. The original 13 members of the Memoir Club, identical with the original 13 members of old Bloomsbury, were all intimate friends, and it was agreed we should be absolutely frank in what we wrote and read.
In the 20s and subsequent 30s, the pinnacle of every young man's literary ambition was to be invited to one of Virginia Woolf's Sunday morning soirees. These were invariably held at her home, No. 52 Tavistock Square, where I was a frequent visitor, for I was distantly related to the Woolf family through some Alsatian cousins. The door of No. 52 was invariably opened by the maid, George, the friend of Lytton Strachey's, who would show one upstairs. I can see that room now, full of talk and smoke and people, and what extraordinary people they were. Elliot was there, Auden, Spender and Isherwood, the old faithfuls and the young hopefuls, but always there was someone one never quite expected to see. I saw A. E. Houseman there once, lured down from Cambridge by Dady Rylands and the prospect of all-in wrestling at Finsbury Park. And there by the window, talking to Leonard and Virginia, were the Berlins, Irving and Isaiah. And then there was Virginia herself, elegant and quizzical, those great nostrils quivering as the sunlight played over her long, pale face. She would be talking of her contemporaries, how she'd spoken last week with Hemingway, how Ernest had said, "When I reach for my gun, I hear the word culture." Some of her books disappointed, vitiated by her intense feminism. Virginia was never a suffragette, for she subscribed to the theory that the pen was mightier than the sword. I once saw Evelyn Waugh reel under a savage blow from her Parker 51. But of all the honours that fell upon Virginia's head, none, I think, pleased her more than the Evening Standard Award for the tallest woman writer of 1927, an award she took by a neck from Elizabeth Bowen, and rightly, I think, because she was in a very real sense the tallest writer I've ever known, which is not to say that her stories were tall. They were not. It was short, but she did stand head and shoulders above her contemporaries, and sometimes, of course, much more so. Dylan Thomas, for instance, a man of great literary stature, only came up to her waist, and sometimes not even there. If I think of Virginia now, it is as she was when I last saw her, in the spring of 1938, outside the changing rooms in the London Library. There she stood, all flushed and hot after a hard day's reading. Impulsively, perhaps, I went up to her and seized her hand. "It's Mrs. Wolfe, isn't it?" "Is it?" she said, and looked at me out of those large, limpid eyes. "Is it?" I often wonder. And she wandered away.
"Highbrow layabouts, that's who they were. I've no time for them at all. The silly way of talking they had. How simply too extraordinary, they used to say about the most humdrum occurrence. If you blew your nose, it was exquisitely civilized. Darwin's and Huxley's and Stevens and Strachey's all living in one another's pockets and marrying each other. And they were all socialists. Why is it always the intelligent people who are socialists?"
Nursie, it's supposed to be broken.
But it hurts.
Well, it would hurt if it was broken. Keep still.
Well, what's it for?
My nursing course.
Nursing course. In my day, nurses had better things to do than bandage the nannies.
Christopher says, the country is rather like Aldershot. Mm. All sand and pine trees. What bit I can see of it is very uninviting, so I shan't miss the walks.
He won't like being a prisoner of war.
I don't mind being a prisoner of war. It's not half as bad as school, really, and the food slightly better. There are 7 old Malburians in my hut.
Oh, that's nice.
Which is rather a bore. They display to the full a disgusting capacity for making the best of a bad job. Tell Nursie I'm wearing her socks.
He's wearing your socks, Nursie.
I could have knitted half a dozen pairs while I've been stuck here being bandaged. Oh! There's no need to throttle me.
A disturbingly high proportion of my fellows appears to welcome incarceration as a longed-for opportunity to dress up as chorus girls. Hmm? Meanwhile, the rest burrow fruitlessly under the foundations. Given half a chance, the English revert with sickening alacrity to their school days. Those bracing phrases I thought to have heard the last of when my headmaster's door closed behind me ring out new-minted on the alien air of Silesia, pulling one's weight, letting the side down. Putting a face on it. However, I find I'm kept quite busy, lying on my bed all day, sleeping. And also reading, an activity which is regarded as mildly eccentric. Would you please send me any copies of this Horizon magazine you come across? Much love, Christopher.
Of course, he's joking, isn't he?
Joking indeed, and him a prisoner of war. He ought to be ashamed of himself.
You don't think... You don't think they forced him to write it at gunpoint like P.G. Woodhouse, do you? Just to undermine our morale.
The death of Lord Rosebery. On the evening of the 20th of May, 1929, Lord Rosebery sank into a coma, and in the early hours of the morning of May the 21st, with his son and Lady Leckenfield by his bed, he died. He had given instructions that a record of the Eton boating song was to be played as he died. And this wish was actually carried out, although it is doubtful if he heard the haunting music, redolent of hot summer afternoons, the quiet laughter of friends, and the golden days of his young manhood.
Are you sure you've got the catechism all buttoned up, Forster?
I'm still a bit hazy about the Trinity, sir.
3 in 1, 1 in 3. It's perfectly straightforward. No doubts about that. See your math master.
Yes, sir.
Well, Forster, here at St. Onan's, I usually try to make my last confirmation class rather more of a personal chat than a theological thing. We've been through the 39 articles together. We know each other pretty well. I don't want to go on calling you Foster. What's your nickname? What do your friends call you?
Nipbag, sir.
Well, Foster, what I want to tackle now is this problem of your body. Now, your body's laid out on fairly simple, straightforward sort of lines, isn't it? You've got 2 arms and your 2 legs, and there's that valiant work of the heart and his 2 stout cronies, the lungs. It's all pretty straightforward.
Yes, sir.
And here we come to the crux. You're not embarrassed about this, are you, Foster? No need to be embarrassed about it. You're a bright, observant sort of lad. You've probably noticed when you've been slipping into your togs or getting into your little gym jams. When you get down here, things aren't straightforward at all.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Good, good. And I suppose you must have wondered how it is that God, who, by and large, made such a splendid job of the rest of your little body, made such a boss shot at that particular bit.
Yes, sir.
Well, I agree with you. But you see, God, whatever else he is, and of course he is everything else, he's not a fool. It's not pretty, but it was put there for a purpose. Point taken, Foster?
Yes, sir.
Good. Of course, I know you're a bit of a scallywag. Probably anything I say to you will just go up one trouser leg and down the other.
This has gone too far. Crabtree, lower the curtain immediately.
Yes, sir.
Confess, not another word shall you utter. Franklin, I'm going to put my foot down. You boy, get off the stage before you are irredeemably corrupted.
What?
Do you defy me, sir? Off! Franklin, where are you? Don't sulk. Oh, you've gone too far this time. Tempest.
Don't blame me, headmaster. I'm an executant, man.
If you're not off the stage by the time I count three, Franklin!
What is it exactly that you're objecting to, headmaster?
This confirmation class. This defamation class. It's not funny, Tempest.
I'm sure it wasn't anything like yours, headmaster.
Not like mine. Of course it was like mine. It was mine.
But the boys and I improvised it together.
Improvised, improvised. It is word for word as I have been delivering it these 40 years. Improvised indeed, cribbed and ridiculed. No wonder you discouraged me from the rehearsals. I suppose that's where all this improvising, as you call it, went on. Well, I won't have it! I'm all in favour of free expression, provided it's kept rigidly under control.
It's only entertainment, so when all's said and done.
It is by no means all said and done, and it is not entertainment. Do I look entertained?
Have you ever thought, Headmaster, that your standards might perhaps be a little out of date?
Of course they're out of date. Standards always are out of date. That's what makes them standards. I'm as broad-minded as the next man, but I have heard matters discussed here which ought never to be mentioned except in the privacy of one's own bathroom, and even then in hushed tones. This is Albion House, not Liberty Hall.
I think you ought to sit down, headmaster.
Yes, I think I had on my last day as headmaster. You might have waited, frankly.
Shall I undo your cup?
You'll undo nothing. You've undone quite enough as it is. All these years I've been at Albion House, years which have seen the decline of authority, the decay of standards, the slow collapse of all I hold most dear. And now this. Mark my words. When a society has to resort to the lavatory for its humour, the writing is on the wall.
You're a different generation, headmaster.
So are you, Franklin. However daring and outspoken you are to the boys, you're a master. And all your swearing and your smut and your silk handkerchiefs and suede shoes won't alter that. We're in the same boat, Franklin, you and I. Now what was going to be next? Oh, yes. Sapper, that sounds a bit better.
Perhaps you'd like to read this next bit, Headmaster. It's more up your street.
Yes, 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 this is more like it. This is the 20s and the 30s, isn't it? The difference is you'd read it with your tongue in your cheek. Just because there are hundreds of thousands of unemployed doesn't mean there weren't some of us trying to lead upright, decent lives.
I can remember some wonderful holidays in St. Leonard's.
That is a page of memory I'm quite ready to leave unturned. But let's have no more of it. Simply because I'm the headmaster doesn't mean I'm a complete fool. Crabtree, why don't you draw up the curtain? Ladies and gentlemen, it is the year 1936. Whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever is best in England, I take to be the breed. That exclusive club whose members are the very pith and sinew of this island. You may run across them in the long room at Lord's or dining alone at White's. Once met, you will always know them, for their hand is firm and their eye is clear. And on those rare occasions when they speak, it is well to listen, for they choose their words dangerously well. They hold themselves in trust for God and for the nation, and they will never fail her, for the breed never dies.
No, the breed never dies. Sapper, Buchan, Dawnford Yeats, practitioners in that school of snobbery with violence that runs like a thread of good class tweed through 20th century literature. Novels of a Europe where history is still a human process, and thrones rise and fall at the behest of international villains. You've got some first-class Holbeins.
Ned?
Yes?
I asked you here for a purpose.
Yes?
Do you remember the last time I saw you?
Intimately, it was at a little thing called Mons.
Since then, I seem to have lost your spoor.
I came through the war more or less intact. I lost an arm here, near there, but I was all right. Perhaps I'd better off than a few million other poor devils, anyway. Then I got back home, and there were these weary willies and tired Tims in their hand-woven ties, writing gibberish they called poetry, saying we'd all been wasting our time. Well, I couldn't see it myself. If we'd done nothing else by 1918, at least we'd saved the follow-on.
Ned, did you ever hear of a man called George Ampersand?
Bostonian philanthropist and friend of King's, who hasn't?
Look at these snapshots. He's surrounded by some of the worst villains in Europe. Irma, his wife. Nature played a cruel trick upon her by giving her a waxed moustache. Sandro, his valet. A cripple of the worst sort and consumptive into the bargain.
Is he sane?
Sane? He's brilliantly sane. The second sanest in Europe. But like all sane men, he has at one time or another crossed that thin bridge that separates lunacy from insanity. And this last week the pace has quickened. Else explain why a highly respected Archbishop of Canterbury, an international hairdresser, and a very famous king all decide to take simultaneous holidays on the Black Sea.
Take a look at this snapshot. It's of a simultaneous holiday on the Black Sea.
But that...
Exactly. A young man not entirely unconnected with the throne of England.
Who's she?
She's beautiful, isn't she? An American. Women are queer cattle at the best of times, but she's like no other woman I've ever known. Mm. She has all the slim grace of a boy and all the delicacy of a young colt.
It's a rare combination. Who's this?
Completely unscrupulous, the Greek shipping magnet.
He's got himself into a pretty rum set, and yet he looks happy.
That's what Mr. Baldwin doesn't like about it. During the past few months, certain reports have been appearing in what, for want of a better word, the Americans call their newspapers.
About her?
Yes.
And him?
Yes.
But I don't understand. Where lies the difficulty? If he loves her...
I don't think you understand. She is what we in the Church of England call a divorced woman.
God, it's filthy.
A divorced woman on the throne of the House of Windsor would be a pretty big feather in the cap of that bunch of ruthless intellectuals, alien Jews, and international pederasts who call themselves the Labour Party.
Hey, little hen, when will you lay me an egg for my tea? Hey, little hen, when will you try to supply one for me?
A better door than a window.
You ought to be still for a minute.
It'll be time enough to sit still when we get to the duration.
What are you doing?
I'm doing what Mr. Beveridge says we're going to have to do. Adapt myself to change in circumstances. I'm sewing a button on your mink coat.
The invasion started.
Queen Anne's dead.
I've just seen Winston announcing it in the house. Face as white as a sheet.
Do you know, I thought the canteen had been busy. I thought my baking must be improving. It's going to be all right, isn't it?
Better ask the Americans. They've got as much to do with it as we have. You'd never have guessed, listening to them cheering in the house today, that these were the same men who marched year by year into the lobbies behind Baldwin and Chamberlain.
You want to be thankful they came to their senses in time.
I should have thought they had. One of my colleagues actually stood up in his constituency the other day and said that if only Hitler indulged in the fine sport of fox hunting, Europe would not be in the condition it's in today.
I suppose some of the men in the barges this morning were fox hunters.
All of them, no doubt, reading over the St. Crispin speech. And I suppose I'm one of the gentlemen of England, now abed.
Why is it called D-Day particularly?
I wish I thought we were all fighting for the same England. I thought when it started, this war would see the end of the businessmen, the property developers, the mulberry-faced gentlemen with carnations in their buttonholes, the men who didn't want this war. As the end draws nearer, you see, they're still there. Ranged behind Churchill now, the very men who kept him out of office all through the 30s. And they'll destroy him yet, because it's their England he's fighting for, the England of Kingsley Wood, who wouldn't bomb Krupp's because it was private property. The England of Geoffrey Dawson, altering the dispatches from Berlin. We shall win this war, but when it ends, there will have to be a reckoning. Then they'll go down, and they'll drag Churchill with them. And us, too. That's the England of the breed. They were saying down at the house that there have been some peculiar rocket planes falling in Kent. It's all very secret.
September 1938. Harold Nicholson and the announcement of Munich. It was 4:12. Chamberlain had been speaking for exactly an hour. I noticed that a sheet of Foreign Office paper was being passed rapidly along the government bench. Sir John Simon interrupted the Prime Minister, and there was a momentary hush. He adjusted his pince-nez and read the document that had been handed to him. Herr Hitler, he said, has just agreed to postpone his mobilization for 24 hours and to meet me in conference with Signor Mussolini and Monsieur Daladier at Munich. For a second, the house was hushed in absolute silence, and then the whole house burst into a roar of cheering, since they knew that this might mean peace. That was the end of the Prime Minister's speech, and when he sat down, the whole house rose as a man to pay tribute to his achievement. I remained seated. Liddell, the Conservative member for Lincoln behind me, hisses out, "Stand up, you brute."
Court of History is now in session. Put up the prisoner.
You are Neville Joseph Chamberlain, formerly of No. 10 Downing Street.
One moment. Everybody knows who the prisoner is. But who are you?
Counsel for the defence, my lord. Solicitors appearing for the defendant are Mrs. Wealthy, Witty and Wise. I am Witty, my lord.
That will be for me to judge. However, before we proceed further, I must warn you, Mr. Chamberlain, that this court is not a court of justice, it is a court of history. And in this court we judge solely by appearances, and I don't like yours. Why are you wearing that ridiculous wing collar?
It was the fashion when I was alive, lad.
Fashion. Slavish adherence to fashion is hardly one of the qualities one looks for in a prime minister. It is in the fashion nowadays to wear long hair, but I don't. You've got off to a very bad start, Mr. Chamberlain. Proceed.
Mr. Chamberlain, you are charged on the night of September the 30th, 1938. You did indecently expose yourself at the windows of your home, No. 10 Downing Street, clad only in a scrap of paper and shouting, "Peace with honour, peace with honour." I say you're guilty or not guilty.
I'm not sure.
Mr. Chamberlain, you are either guilty or not guilty. That is something you must decide for yourself. The court cannot decide it for you. I shall now proceed to the sentence.
But the evidence...
The prisoner has come here for sentence. Let us get that out of the way before we hear the evidence. First things first.
It's usual to have the evidence first, my lad.
Don't try to tie me up in legal mumbo-jumbo. I know the trial procedure backwards.
The charge arises out of a visit made by the accused to Munich to see Herr Hitler in the autumn of 1938.
By aeroplane.
What has that got to do with it?
I went by aeroplane. I was 69. I'd never flown in my life before. I was the first Prime Minister ever to fly.
It may be the substance of a small footnote in the history of aeronautics, Mr. Chamberlain, but it is of no relevance to the Court of History. What was your occupation at the time the offence was committed?
Prime Minister and leader of the Conservative Party.
Prime Minister and leader of the Conservative Party. You were doing two jobs?
There was very little distinction between them.
There was very little distinction between them. That was partly the trouble, wasn't it?
Oh, you're excelling yourself, Mr. Whitty. You'll have to do better than this, Mr. Chamberlain.
Let us look at Herr Hitler. It must have been obvious to anyone that he was a patent scallywag.
Oh, he was not a gentleman, certainly. But he was very fond of dogs.
For sovereign states to conclude agreements on the basis of a mutual fondness for dogs seems to me to be barking up the wrong tree.
But it was what the people wanted.
The law of history is not a law of supply and demand, Mr. Chamberlain.
Good. Now we come to the pith and gist of the proceedings. The sentence. Members of the jury, I want you to consider the following question. Was Mr. Neville Chamberlain a mixed blessing, or was he an unmixed evil, right on one side of the question only? Neville Joseph Chamberlain, have you anything to say before I pass sentence upon you?
I was a very ordinary man, my lad.
You're not here for offending against the law of averages. Anything else?
I did die shortly after leaving office.
Mr. Chamberlain, it is given to most of us to die at some time or other in our lives. It is no excuse. And keep your mouth shut when you're talking to me. Any extenuating circumstances?
The accused was born in Birmingham, my lad.
So are a great many other people. That is no excuse. Prisoner at the bar, you have been found guilty in the court of history and by full process of time, and I have no alternative but to give you a very short sentence, so short indeed that there are only two words in it, perpetual ignominy.
That sentence is impossible. There's no verb in it.
The verb is understood. Take him down.
September 1939. Mr. Chamberlain still hesitates. At 7:30 that Saturday evening, as the German armies thundered towards Warsaw, the Prime Minister appeared in the Commons. The chamber was packed. Members on all sides of the House expected at long last to be told of an ultimatum. When Chamberlain stood up, it was to talk of a conference. If the Germans would agree to withdraw their troops, the question of Poland could be settled through diplomatic channels. There was no word of an ultimatum. Two MPs were sick. Amory and Duff Cooper were red-faced and speechless with fury. Chamberlain sat down without a cheer. The chief whip feared physical violence. And when Arthur Greenwood, the acting Labour leader, rose to speak, Amory shouted from the Conservative benches, "Speak for England, Arthur."
So in 1939, at the start of another war, Max Beerbohm, an old man and a legend before the first war started, comes home from the Villino at Rapallo and Somerset Maugham in a crowded tramp steamer from Vichy, France. Home to an England where Cyril Connolly is founding Horizon and there are lunchtime concerts in the National Gallery. And nightly in the basement of Claridge's in the Savoy, the saving remnant of the old England sits out the Blitz. But by now their ranks are thinning. In May 1936, T.E. Lawrence, swerving to avoid a couple of errand boys, where are they now? plunges his motorbike over a hedge. At Tunbridge Wells, a month before Hitler enters Austria, Ottilien Murrell dies. Little Buchan, a mere 8 stone 12 pounds, falls down with a heart attack in a Montreal bathroom in 1940. And Virginia Woolf, filling her pockets with stones, walks into the River Ouse on the 28th of March 1941 with her hat still firmly on her head. Eddie Marsh, friend and patron of the first war poets, flits from country house to country house, an awkward guest, apt often to forget the war and eat the entire family bacon ration at one go. And all through the war, Mrs. Keppel, once the mistress of Edward VII, puts up the blackout at the windows of Watlington Park and dreams of the great days in the distance enchanted, and that strange, storied world before 1914.
The white cliffs of Dover, tomorrow, just you wait and see.
The representative of the German High Command and of Grand Admiral Dönitz, the designated head of the German state, signed the act of unconditional surrender of all German land, sea, and air.
Well, that's the end of that. On the whole, I suppose a very pointful war.
Yes, I said it would be. And here's Christopher back. Hello, dear.
Hello.
The circle's complete, just like old times.
Well, let's hope so, anyway.
I never did find that gas mask.
And you thought it'd all be over by Christmas.
They said that last time. Now, have we got everything? Rugs, bottles, wireless, I think that's everything.
Well, everything that matters, anyway. We'll soon know if we've lost anything.
All that fuss, and I don't seem to care anymore.
Don't care was made to care. Don't care was on. Don't care was put in a pot and boiled till he was done.
It is 1968. In our crass-builded, glass-bloated, green-belted world, Sunday is for washing the car, tinned peaches and carnation milk.
A sergeant's world it is now. The world of the lay-by,
and the Civic Improvement Scheme.
Country is park, and shore is marina. Spare time is leisure, and more, year by year. We have become a battery people, a people of underprivileged hearts, fed on pap in darkness, bred out of all taste and season to savour the shoddy splendours of the new civility. The hedges come down from the silent fields. The lease is out on the corner site. A butterfly is an event.
Were we closer to the ground as children, or is the grass emptier now?
Tidy the old into the tall flats. Desolation at 14 stories becomes a view.
Who now dies at home? Who sees death? We sicken and fade in a hospital ward, and dying is for doctors with a phone call to the family.
Once we had a romantic and old-fashioned conception of honour, of patriotism, chivalry and duty. But it was a duty which didn't have much to do with justice, with social justice anyway. And in default of that justice, and in pursuit of it, that was how the great words came to be cancelled out. The crowd has found the door into the secret garden. Now they will tear up the flowers by the roots, strip the borders, and strew them with paper and broken bottles.
To let, a valuable site at the crossroads of the world. At present on offer to European clients. Outlying portions of the estate already disposed of to sitting tenants. Of some historical and period interest, some alterations and improvements necessary.
That was 40 Years On by Alan Bennett, with John Gielgud as the headmaster, Dorothy Reynolds as matron, Alan Bennett as Tempest, Paul Eddington as Franklin, Nora Nicholson as Miss Nisbet, and Sam Dastor as the head boy. Other parts were played by Nigel Anthony, Stephen Bone, Adrian Hall, Nigel Rathbone, and Clive Swift. Radio voice, Alvar Liddell. Musical settings by Carl Davis. Accompanied songs sung by Boys of the City of London School, directed by Anthony Gould. The treble soloists were Simon Preece and Simon Pairmain. The play was produced by Richard Wortley.